This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Irish Studies, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. My name is Aidan Beattie. I'm one of the co-hosts of this channel. Today, we're talking to Robert Savage, a professor in the Boston College History Department, who has also served as one of the directors of that university's Irish Studies program for close to 20 years now. He has been awarded visiting fellowships at Trinity College Dublin, the University of Edinburgh, Queen's University Belfast, and the university that now calls itself University of Galway. Professor Savage's publications explore contemporary Irish and British history, and include the BBC's Irish Troubles Television Conflict in Northern Ireland in 2015, shortlisted for the Ewart Biggs Literary Award, A Loss of Innocence, Television and Irish Society, 1960 to 1972, which in 2010 won the James S. Donnelly Senior Book Prize from the American Conference for Irish Studies, and Sean Lamass, a biography in 2014. His most recent book is Northern Ireland, the BBC, and Censorship in Thatcher's Britain, published earlier this year with Oxford University Press. And that is the book we'll be discussing today. Professor Savage, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Aidan.
Thanks a lot. So your book obviously builds on your previous work on censorship and on the BBC during the Troubles. What did you find here that challenged what you'd found in the past or that complicated what you'd previously researched?
This most recent book really picks up where my 2015 book had left off. The book that I wrote and published in 2015, The BBC's Irish Troubles, looked at the history of the BBC in Northern Ireland from the 1920s up until the early 1980s. And it also looked at the way in which the national network covered Northern Ireland. When I was finishing that book, I was a bit frustrated because I could not get access to material from the 1980s. The written archive at Caversham, you know, that houses all of the BBC material, the archivist there told me that the material I wanted access to simply hadn't been vetted yet, and that it could take years for the material to be cleared by the lawyers of the BBC. So I, you know, sent off the book, and it was published in 2015. And about 6 months, maybe a year later, I heard from the archivist that I had been working with at the BBC, who told me that all the material that I had been looking for had now been cleared. So I was a bit frustrated, and I wasn't sure what exactly was there. I made my way to London and, you know, out to the archive, and realized that there was a tremendous amount of material that really detailed the way in which the BBC struggled to report accurately about the conflict in Northern Ireland. And I realized that there was so much information that had never been seen before that explained the wrangling that went on between the Thatcher government and the BBC, that you know, there was a book there. And that's what came out earlier this summer, a book about the Thatcher government's efforts to try and control the narrative of the Troubles and try and shape the way in which regional, national, and international audiences understood the conflict.
I might come back to that question of international audiences, because obviously that's something quite new in this book compared to the previous book that was obviously very British focused. But could you kind of put the two books together, maybe? How does censorship change and develop over the entire period from 1969 up until the 90s?
Yeah, in fact, I'd go back even before then. When the BBC begins broadcasting in Northern Ireland in 1922, initially it's simply a relay station. It's just broadcasting what's coming out of London. But slowly a regional service emerges, and that regional service is incredibly deferential to the unionist establishment in Belfast. There's a real fear of alienating or angering the unionist government. And there's a sort of self-censorship that develops within the regional service. You know, any time that the national service stumbles into the field of Irish history, it creates real problems inside of Northern Ireland. The unionist government is incredibly sensitive about its image. And when the national network, for instance, might broadcast on St. Patrick's Day, a program about Irish culture, there'll be protests from Belfast arguing that Northern Ireland is basically not Irish. Within the regional service in Belfast, any sensitive issue about grievances of the Catholic community, about gerrymandering, about discrimination, are simply avoided. They're not tolerated. The unionist establishment in Belfast is obsessed with its image and wants to be seen as an integral part of the United Kingdom, as a British part of the United Kingdom, and therefore really does not tolerate much in the way of Gaelic cultural broadcasting or programming. And that evolves. You know, then when the Troubles break out in 1969, you know, the national network, the sort of BBC in London, begins to look more critically at Northern Ireland. You know, it had stayed away for decades. It had regarded the BBC and Northern Ireland and the BBC regional service as kind of the Siberia of the BBC, and it simply stayed away. But once you know, the violence breaks out in 1969, journalists from the mainland begin to travel to Northern Ireland and begin to ask some really difficult questions. And the type of self-censorship that had existed in Northern Ireland and even in London in regards to Northern Ireland, that is simply no longer sustainable. And it creates real difficulties for the unionist establishment when journalists make their way across the water, or when local journalists start to ask very difficult questions about discrimination, about the policies of the Stormont government, about policing, about security, about job discrimination, about gerrymandering, and the kind of self-censorship basically implodes.
So maybe if we can go back then to this question of the international image, which obviously is something new in this book. Northern Ireland obviously is a big international story at various points throughout the period from the 60s to the 90s. So how did international media report on Northern Ireland? Is it seen as some kind of post-colonial conflict, some kind of internal European conflict, something totally different?
It's a very good question, and it causes tremendous unease for the British government when the international press, and especially the American press, begins to report on the civil rights campaign in Northern Ireland and make comparisons to what's going on in the American South. Early American reports about the outbreak of violence compares Catholics in Northern Ireland with the blacks of the United States, arguing that they've been discriminated against for centuries. And they begin to equate the Orange Order with the Ku Klux Klan, the RUC with the sheriffs in the American South and places like Mississippi and Alabama, all very simplistic comparisons, but comparisons that reflect really poorly on the British government. And the British government is tremendously sensitive to the way in which its image is being compromised. And this is true in other parts of the world, whether it's in Europe or, as you can imagine, in Eastern Europe or the Soviet Union. Of course, this is all taking place at the height of the Cold War, Eastern European, the Soviet government, the Chinese government, point to what's going on in Northern Ireland, arguing that this is a remnant of the empire, that this is a sort of remnant of the colonialism, and that the IRA and others are fighting a legitimate war of liberation. So, this is something that creates tremendous discomfort in London as well as Belfast.
And could you kind of go more into detail then of how did the British government actually try to manage and even maybe massage some of this? You talk about that a little bit, particularly with the US.
Yeah, there's an effort to try and explain Northern Ireland more clearly. There's a propaganda effort, as it's termed, within the British Embassy in Washington. They begin to lobby politicians. They begin to write op-ed pieces and court what they regard as important political leaders in Washington to try and make the case that the British and the British Army are simply peacemakers, that they're there to try and prevent disorder. And they're fighting a sort of an enemy that are, terrorists. So they, try and present a more simplistic narrative, arguing that they're peacemakers, that they are not biased. But that's a really difficult sell. And, all of their efforts can easily be undermined by news and current affairs reporting, and especially by television broadcasts. For instance, the reports from Derry on Bloody Sunday in 1972 create tremendous unease in London. Many of the networks in the United States, and in fact around the world, will pick up feeds from the BBC and the independent television companies that are covering the protest in Derry in January 1972. And, especially, sort of interviews that are from the street in the aftermath of the shooting, they will really sort of undermine all of the efforts that the British government has made to try and present itself as peacekeepers, and that's something that causes tremendous embarrassment. So the British government is constantly trying to influence the way in which the Troubles will be understood, both regionally, nationally, and internationally. And this is going to be increasingly difficult as aggressive news and current affairs reporters from the BBC and the independent networks begin to ask difficult questions about British policy, about the policies pursued by the army, by the security services, and about plans to try and bring an end to the violence. Mm-hmm.
So you have a whole chapter in your book about the hunger strikes in 81, and those are obviously a moment where a lot of these problems from a British government perspective are really coming to the fore, right? You have Bobby Sands, this pretty photogenic character, this photogenic leader, and then you have Sinn Féin, who are obviously quite aware of the propaganda benefits that they're accruing from all this. So when we look at the hunger strikes today, how would you say that a media history and the history of censorship would change our understanding of what happened then?
Yeah. Well, you know, the Sinn Féin and the IRA had become increasingly frustrated that their efforts to win back special category status inside of the Mays prison weren't getting anywhere in the late 70s and in 1980 and the beginning of 1981. But once especially the Sands hunger strike begins to gain momentum, you know, it's a sensational story. And the broadcast media makes its way to Belfast to tell a very compelling story. And you know, Sands dies after 66 days on hunger strike. And one can look at the international media initially attracted to the story. And as the hunger strike grows, this moves up to become the leading story in the CBS Evening News, for instance, here in the United States, or in you know any of the national news broadcasts. And the way in which Sinn Féin is able to sort of present the hunger strike is that you know Bobby Sands is a you know an attractive young volunteer, somebody who's willing to sacrifice his life for freedom. And the images that make their way into the international media are really interesting. The image of Bobby Sands that we're all familiar with was from a photograph taken inside of the Mays prison with a small Instamatic camera. It was smuggled back out. It was released to the press. And that smiling picture of a long-haired, youthful Bobby Sands would often be juxtaposed next to, you know, the sort of frowning face of Margaret Thatcher, who would be repeating, you know, a crime is a crime is a crime. It's not political. And, you know, the sort of juxtaposition of this young, charismatic character with the sort of dour, stern face of Margaret Thatcher became... you know, these two images sort of battled with one another, and you know the it underscored just how successful Sinn Féin was in sort of promoting its own narrative about the conflict, and the fact that Sands was then elected as a member of parliament only added to the story, making it a really compelling one. Without the broadcast media there, especially without television, you know, I'm not sure the story would have been the international one that it became.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Sure. Maybe if we could stay in that kind of international context, you talk quite a bit in your book about NORAID. One random thing I was thinking about as I was reading your book was, a few years ago, I was doing research of my own on something totally unrelated to Northern Ireland, but on the 80s in Ireland. And I was going through various newspapers from the period, and NORAID come up quite a bit. And I was quite shocked about how terrified people in Ireland, like people in the Irish establishment, were about NORAID. So maybe if you could just explain, first of all, who this group were, and then what kind of role they played in the conflict, what problems they pose for the British government.
Sure. Well, NORAID was unapologetically Republican. They supported the IRA. They always made the case that they were not supplying money or weapons to the IRA, but nobody really believed them. They made the case that they were raising money to assist of families whose loved ones were incarcerated by the British, or families who had lost members to the violence of the Troubles. But again, NORAID was raising money from the IRA, and the American government knew that, as did the British and Irish governments. NORAID alarmed a lot of people, not only in the United Kingdom and in Ireland, but here in the United States. It's one of the things that John Hume was really successful in doing is arguing against NORAID, arguing that the money that was going to NORAID was only going to increase the misery that taking place in Northern Ireland. But NORAID was a tenacious group of that was well organized. In 1983, they mounted a very famous people's tour, meant to be an educational tour for Americans interested in the conflict in Northern Ireland. Over 80 NORAID supporters made their way to Dublin. They were greeted by Joe Cahill, a famous Republican IRA leader at Dublin Airport. And they went on a bus tour into Northern Ireland. While traveling in South Armagh, their bus was stopped and boarded by fully sort of uniformed members of the IRA who received cheers from the crowd. This created tremendous concern for the British government as well as the Irish government. And, you know, the press, the British and Irish press looked at NORAID and its leader in Ireland during this time, Martin Galvin, who was a lawyer from New York who traveled with the group. And, the press lampooned the group. They argued that they were simplistic, that they didn't understand the conflict, that they were dangerous because of the money that they were raising. And when in 1984, Martin Galvin in New York mentioned that he would once again bring a group of NORAID supporters to Northern Ireland, there was a debate within the British government about what it should do. The Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, as well as the Northern Ireland office, told the Thatcher government that that Martin Galvin should be banned. But this was something that was opposed by the British Embassy in Washington, as well as the Foreign Secretary, Geoffrey Howe. You know, both Howe and the Foreign Office believed that if you try and ban Galvin from coming into Northern Ireland, that it was inevitably going to fail, and it was going to only provide more publicity for NORAID. But in the end, the British government followed the advice of the Northern Ireland office. They issued a ban forbidding Martin Galvin from coming to Northern Ireland and making it clear that if he did make his way across the border, that he'd be arrested and deported. So Galvin, of course, arrives in Dublin, makes his way to Derry, is able to get into the city, is interviewed by the Derry Journal, is filmed by the BBC in Northern Ireland, and then comes to Belfast, where a rally is held to welcome him. When he makes his way onto the stage, the RUC, which is out in force, at this demonstration, tries to intervene to arrest him, and all hell breaks loose. And this is, again, 1984 in Belfast. The international media is there to record what happens. When the RUC intervene, there's violence, there are fights. An RUC officer shoots a young 21-year-old Sean Downs with a plastic bullet. He is killed. Galvin escapes. He never makes any real speech. He escapes and makes his way back into the Republic and back to New York. And it's a fiasco for the British government because all of this mayhem has been filmed. And there are reporters there from the New York Times, the Washington Post, as well as the international British and Irish media. And the story becomes one of police brutality, of the fact that the RUC had overreacted, had gone into the crowd wielding truncheons, beaten people up, and actually killed somebody with a plastic bullet. And then stories begin to appear in the international press about plastic bullets and the sort of the way in which they're used and the number of people that have been killed. And the fact that most of those that have been killed by plastic bullets have been Catholics. The fact that, within the European community, plastic bullets aren't used. So it just becomes you know, a public relations nightmare for the RUC, for the British government, and a sort of, you know, a sort of real boost for the Republican movement. You know, Sean Downes loses his life, unfortunately, but, you know, this is the sort of thing that drives Margaret Thatcher and her supporters crazy. You know, they hate the fact that the RUC and the British government are being portrayed as heavy-handed, as endorsing and promoting police violence. You know, this is the narrative that they want to avoid. But they, you know, time and time again, they are frustrated by the way in which the story of the Troubles is making its way into the media, and especially into the international print and broadcast media.
So maybe if we could talk a little bit about how Thatcher then does respond. I think one thing that even people out, very much outside of media history will be quite aware of is this broadcasting ban that she brings in, or her government bring in 1988. So is that a continuation of longstanding policies, or do you see that as something new?
Well, no, it is. You know, censorship had been something that had been debated within the Thatcher government, within the government that preceded her. The Labour government had looked at the way in which censorship might be implemented in Northern Ireland. Roy Mason, the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, in the Labour government, had been an advocate of censorship. He and Margaret Thatcher agreed before Thatcher became prime minister, that there should be a coordinated response, that both Labour as well as the Tories should be on the same page when it came to the way in which the media should be handled. You know, when Thatcher comes to power in 1979, she looks at Northern Ireland and is horrified by what she sees. Of course, her political mentor, Éire Neave, had been assassinated by the INLA, you know, Republican group. And she looked at the sort of the way in which the media dealt with Northern Ireland and was always uncomfortable, although she declared time and time again that censorship was not on, that it couldn't work in a democracy. But by 1988, after a particular grisly series of events, she decided that she'd change her mind. You know, 1988 would see horrific violence. You know, there'd be a cycle of violence that would begin in Gibraltar when three unarmed members of the IRA would be shot dead by the SAS. There'd be killings by Michael Stone at Milltown Cemetery, a loyalist who would kill a number of mourners who had come to the cemetery in Belfast to bury those that had been killed at Gibraltar. And then when a funeral for one of those that had been killed at Milltown Cemetery made its way through Belfast, two British corporals would abruptly appear at the funeral cortege and you know, be dragged from their car and killed by the IRA. It would be seemingly a cycle of violence. And then a short time later, there'd be a number of young soldiers that would be you know, killed in a bombing that would take place in rural Tyrone. So it seemed as if the violence was accelerating. And there was a fear that it would make its way back onto the British mainland. And in October 1988, you know, Margaret Thatcher just decides that something has to be done. And that's when the broadcast ban is announced in Parliament, and which forbids the voice of anybody supporting violence from having access to the airwaves. Of course, it's aimed specifically at Sinn Féin, although, you know, the Protestant paramilitaries are also named. But it's, you know, it highlights the level of frustration within the Thatcher government, and especially by Tom King, the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, and Margaret Thatcher herself.
So do you see this as a kind of a specific isolated case of censorship, or would you connect it to kind of the broader history of allegations of state interference in the BBC and things like that?
No, I mean there, you know, this sort of official censorship in 1988 is really not all that surprising. You know, one can see that there's pressure building throughout the 70s and throughout the 80s. There's tremendous frustration. And what the Labor and conservative governments had been able to do was to basically bully and threaten the broadcast media. You know, in 1979, Margaret Thatcher's government makes it clear that the Prevention of Terrorism Act will be deployed against any journalist that comes into contact with the IRA. And so there's always, you know, a threat of censorship. There's always a degree of bullying. And Margaret Thatcher begins to pack the board of the BBC with those that are sympathetic to her concerns, with Tories, with, you know, sort of people that think like her and want to try and rein in, as they would see it, the BBC. So, you know, censorship is always there, but it becomes official in 1988. And of course, censorship has been a fact of life in the Irish Republic since the early 1970s. And this is something that the British government really admires. They like the fact that the Irish government has been able to ban Sinn Féin and anybody that supports violence in the north from the airwaves. In fact, it's interesting when one looks at the cabinet minutes from 1988, Douglas Hurd is the Home Secretary, and he's the one that will make the announcement in the House of Commons. And he distributes talking points to his to the rest of the cabinet. And they're told, you know, how to respond to reporters' questions, to questions that might be quite aggressive and challenging the British government about the imposition of censorship. And one of the arguments that cabinet members, ministers are told to make is that this is something that the Irish Republic has endorsed for many, many years, and it's been successful. So it's just sort of highlights the fact that censorship had been something that, you know, the British government had been thinking about, that the Northern Ireland office had advocated in the 1970s, although by the late 1980s, the Northern Ireland office is becoming really skeptical about whether or not it would actually work.
So maybe just as a final question, do you think there's more still to be done about the history of the Troubles and TV, or will you go off in a totally different direction now that you've written two books on the topic?
Yeah, well, I've done my work on it. I think there's still more that can be done. You know, much of my work is, you know, I'm not a media studies person. I'm a historian, and you know, my work, you know, benefits from, you know, going into the archives, you know, digging through the written archives at Caversham, looking at the Public Records Office in Northern Ireland in Belfast, and working in the National Archives at Kew in just outside of London. I've also, you know, tried to sort of look at all of the secondary material that's been written about reporting the Troubles. But I think there's much more that can be done in looking at the journalists that actually covered these events. You know, I've spoken to some BBC reporters and journalists who were and editors who were working in the 70s and 80s, and their stories really haven't been told. I mean, there are a couple of very good books that have just been published over the last couple of years with short bits by reporters that had covered events in Northern Ireland. But I think there could be much more done, you know, by historians that might be interested in the narratives of the Troubles and the way in which these narratives were shaped. And I think that could be done by oral history, by interviewing editors and journalists and managers within both the BBC as well as RTE and the independent television companies that made up the Irish, that were overseen by the Independent Broadcasting Authority.
Well, thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. I mean, the book is incredibly readable and obviously incredibly well-researched.
Thank you.
Northern Ireland, the BBC and Censorship in Thatcher's Britain is out now with Oxford University Press. Professor Savage, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Aidan. It's a pleasure.